You are listening to Truth and Justice Radio here on WZBC Newton. And if all is working correctly, we have on the line with us Carl Dix. I should mention, Carl Dix is a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party of the United States of America. In 70, he was one of the Fort Lewis Six, or GIs, who refused the orders to go to Vietnam. And he served in Leavenworth for his pleasures there. In 96, he was a co-founder of the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality. And it was on a campus tour last year entitled From Buffalo Soldier to Revolutionary Communist. And it was informing students about their right not to fight in our wars. And we are so happy and grateful to have Carl with us on the air. Carl, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty good, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to people up in Boston.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of activity of late since the publication of the draft proposal, Constitution for a New Socialist Republic in North America. I'd like to touch on that briefly and then go back and cover a little bit of the how we got here. So why don't you just give us a few minutes of what it is that has been put out?
Yeah, what this is a document written with the future in mind. It's the Constitution for how a new socialist republic that was brought into being in some section of what used to be the United States, but where a revolution has taken place. This is the rules of the game, the framework for how the new socialist society would be organized and how it would function, what the rights of people are, but also what the responsibilities of people are. Because in that kind of world, there will be radically different economic relations, a radically different political system, and the society will be in transition to a world where antagonistic classes and exploitation and oppression have been gotten rid of once and for all, what we call a full classless communist world. So it's kind of the rules of the game for that, to both let people know what that society would look like, how the government would be organized, how the economy would be run, how the media would work, and to get people thinking about, is that kind of society possible, and is it desirable? Because today, one of the problems that we see is that for many, many people, including a lot of people who don't like a lot of what's going on, they don't think anything different than this is really possible. And we want to get them thinking that there is another way. Things don't have to be like this.
And I was going to mention that by putting this out for discussion and comment, it gives folks an opportunity to try on some new ideas, to offer enhancements, suggestions, improvements perhaps, to refine this. Because when the time comes for a new government to be implemented, because I think we're all pretty clear that our present course is unsustainable, having done the homework in advance will be of great benefit to its securing a more stable future.
Yeah, that's actually the point. I was at a conference around the Constitution, and one of the people speaking on it made exactly that point in relation to a couple of other points. They made the point that having people grapple with the Constitution now will have them thinking about and ready to act on, in the aftermath of revolution, building a new society and building a society that's in transition, because we don't want to just bring in a new system, put some different people in power, and hope they do better. We want to put in position a different society, a different system that can radically change things right away, but also keep working to further transform things, because you won't be able to get rid of everything that's wrong all at once, but you need a system and a society that's aiming to do that. And then the other thing that it will do is, if people are thinking about that kind of future, it can open up for them possibilities in the present, as opposed to feeling locked in to looking for the best Democrat that you can find and hoping that this Democrat is going to be different than all the other Democrats who have, you know, punctured your hopes for change even after you voted for it. So that's a big part of the role that it plays, opening people's minds, getting them thinking about different possibilities and preparing them to act both in the present and in the future.
That brings to mind a couple of questions, the first of which is how engaged and how much traction has the RCP been able to gain for, at least in terms of competing in within our present political system, running for elections and whatnot? Is there a presence in all 50 states? Have candidates been fielded? What is the state of the current state of affairs on that front?
Okay, that's a very good question, and let me speak to the elections part of it first. We do not field candidates for office in elections, and we don't do that because elections aren't where the future course of the society is decided. In fact, the elections are where the people who really run the show, who we refer to as the ruling class, they determine policy amongst themselves and bring forward candidates who represent different policies, and the actual selection process goes on beyond the reach of the public, and then the public gets brought in to endorse it. And we could even look at this 2008 presidential election, an election in which a lot of people told me, because I was out in Harlem election night 2008, and people were telling me, we've made our revolution. We elected the first black president. And they really felt that they were the reason he was president. And in a certain sense, they did cast the votes. But the thing that a lot of them missed was that when a year or more earlier, when the fundraising stats came out, in the very first time, before most people knew who Barack Obama was, Obama was already raising more money than Hillary Clinton. And what that meant was that the venture capitalists in Silicon Valley and the people on Wall Street were voting with their mega dollars for that approach, specifically because they knew that approach could draw disaffected people back into the system, which is what it did. They got behind Obama and got, in large measure, a continuation of what Bush did, but with a different coloration on it. Now, as far as what kind of traction we do have, because just because we don't run people for elections doesn't mean that we're not out there working every day building a movement for revolution, and it has not nearly enough traction. In fact, things are very unfavorably divided up in this society towards the prospect of any kind of change, and especially revolutionary change. And we're working very hard to reverse that. But right now, revolution's a long shot. We admit that and acknowledge that. But at the same time, revolution is the only thing that can really transform this society for the better. There are some things that could transform it for the worst, and a lot of that's concentrated in this fascist movement that's being unleashed under the banner of the Tea Party and all of that kind of stuff. What's needed is for the message that things don't have to be this way, that a better world is possible, to get out there much more broadly. We're putting that out, and we're also speaking to people about how that better world could be brought into being, what this revolution is, how it would be organized, but also what kind of new society it would bring into being. And the Constitution that we've issued is a big and an important part of that. And we're also building resistance to the different ways that the system comes at people, whether that's a question of police brutality, which you referenced in my biography, because we get down and work with people to resist that, whether that's a question of the wars for empire, the government spying, the torture and detentions. We're trying to build resistance on all of those fronts, and we're also trying to engage some of the key questions. I just did a dialogue back at the end of October with Cornel West with the theme of In the Age of Obama, What Future for Our Youth? And through all of those ways, we're trying to break down people being locked into that things have to stay this way, and to open up possibilities for them, and also to rally them to begin to act today to resist in ways that can bring forward the actual possibility of making a revolution in a country like this.
Now, I want to get back a little bit later to the topic of police brutality, and of course it ties in with a lot of the other challenges we're facing, but I wanted to mention that and just discuss briefly the challenges of the decades of stigmatization and propaganda that have been leveled against communism and any effort to bring about a more fair and equitable system here. But the Communist Party in particular has been singled out and demonized for a long time now. And how are you working on the messaging, on your media, on your outreach to diffuse and, deflate that propaganda bubble that's submerged the message for so long?
Yeah, that's another very good question, because we actually hear all the time, and given the terms of things today, people say to us, why don't you rebrand what you're about? Why don't you call it something different? And, we thought about that, but we decided communism is what we're about. It is an apt description of it, because it would be a society and a world where people work and struggle in common for the common good, contributing all to society that they could, and secure in the knowledge that they would get back everything they needed to live a life worthy of human beings, not only in terms of having their material needs met, but also their cultural needs, their ability to engage in intellectual endeavor. So it's the best, and it's a world where exploitation and oppression have been eliminated once and for all, along with antagonistic classes. So it is the best and apt description, but like you say, it's been slandered and almost beaten to death by the imperialists and the capitalists, because they do see it as a challenge to their system, which they like to talk about it as democracy, but what it actually is capitalism. It's the domination of a handful of people whose ownership and control of the natural resources, the factories, the mines, the large farms, the means to produce everything that society needs, allows them to dominate all of society and operate on the basis of a dictatorship, one that serves their interest and their interest only. So what we do is we have done two things. One is that we address that slander, that propaganda, and bring out what the truth is about communist revolution and the many things that it accomplished. At the same time, we fearlessly look at its shortcomings, because while what the capitalists say about communism is a lot of lying slander, there are also very real shortcomings in the history and experience of communist revolution, and it would be wrong to try to skirt those or cover them up. We'd actually be doing the flip side of what the people that run this setup do when they slander communism. And our leader, Bob Avakian, in particular, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, has spent decades looking into that experience. And on the basis of that, he has brought forward a new and different synthesis on how to make communist revolution, how to make it something that would be both possible and desirable, and how to move the society brought into being after the revolution onto the classless world without exploitation. And that synthesis is actually concentrated in the way that this constitution is put together, because it has some things in it that are different in terms of communist revolution. One of the things that it talks about is the need to encourage an atmosphere of inquiry, diversity, debate, and dissent, including from people who oppose the direction of the revolution. And that's drawn from looking at, say, the experience in China, where under Mao, when it was a revolutionary country, because it's no longer a revolutionary country, it's no longer socialist or communist, it's capitalist to the bone, but even under Mao, when it was socialist, they encouraged involvement and dissent from the people who supported the revolution. But those who weren't with the revolution, they didn't want to hear from them. And what Avakian has figured out is that we need to hear from everybody, including those who don't like what you're doing. And it's not enough to characterize what they say. You actually have to hear what they say. And when I say you, I mean the whole society has to hear what they say, because it's on that basis that you get the deepest understanding of what's really going on. And you need to understand what's going on very deeply in order to continue transforming society in the desired direction. It also, the section on how the government's going to be put together after the revolution, including the role of elections in that, something that's very different than previous communist revolutions. So that's how we go at it. One, trying to counter the lies told about communism, but two, actually looking at the very real shortcomings and working on overcoming the shortcomings and errors in that experience.
I wanted to also put into play in this conversation some of the structural challenges inhibiting change. None, or at least very little of this, I feel at least, is accidental in its nature. You may be familiar with a gentleman named John Taylor Gatto?
I'm actually not.
Okay, he...
What's his last name again?
Gatto, G-A-T-T-O.
G-A-T-T-O. I'm going to have to look him up.
Yeah, he basically... There's a recent thing from him is entitled A Short Angry History of American Forced Schooling. And it's sort of a condensed version of a number of prior studies. Now, he got Teacher of the Year Award in New York, I believe on several occasions. And basically, he lays out how the educational system of America was dismembered and replaced essentially with schooling, which would produce a lot of docile, unimaginative workers. And the consequence of this has been a diminishment in the ability of people to think for themselves, to grasp complex ideas, to maintain an attention span. And anyone wishing to bring change has got to get concepts across. Now, when you're speaking to a public who has been dumbed down, the process begins at a lot more basic level than is going to lend itself to fast progress. So for any social change, we have to address the fact that the system has dumbed us down. And
okay,
what...
Go ahead. Are you finished?
Enough. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, what I was going to say is that one of the things that we identify about this society and capitalist society in general is the way in which it operates to lock out of working with ideas and concepts the vast majority of the population. There's a selected few that are largely on the basis of their demonstrated ability to serve the interest of the wealthy and powerful are brought into that arena and trained in it, but most people are locked out. And the educational system does indeed play an important role in that, because many, many people are from very early on in their educational experience directed towards where they're going to end up, you know. And a lot of people, in fact, the majority of society was being trained to be an unimaginative worker, although even that has transformed because there isn't the same need for workers in post-2000 United States of America and much of the industrial world. A lot of the industry has been sent elsewhere in the world in order to make more profit off of it.
And also, as industry, as technology increases, it becomes more and more automated, requiring fewer people, regardless of where it's done. I'd like to read something briefly from this writing from John Gatto. And this is his writing, and I said, let me start with the Designing Education for the Future papers. What he's referring to is in the mid to late 60s, the focus on education changed quite a bit. And there's some other things from back around the turn of the century. I'll get to in just a moment, but he writes this. Let me start with the Designing Education for the Future papers. They were the collusion with the Federal Education Department and a presumably independent state agencies. They redefined education after the 19th century German fashion as, quoting from a document, a means to achieve important economic and social goals for the national character. The Behavioral Teacher Educational Project outlined specific teaching reforms to be forced on the country, unwillingly, of course, after 1967. It also sets out in clear language the outlook and intent of its creators. Quoting again, the impersonal manipulation through schooling of a future America in which few will be able to maintain control over their own opinions. Each individual receives at birth a multipurpose identification number, which enables employers and other controllers to keep track of them and to expose them to the director's subliminal influence of the state education department and the federal department acting through those whenever necessary. And in essence, what this does is it primes the pump for control. It channels our avenues of thought to conform within the system that desires our compliance. In order to have a revolution of governance, we have to, it seems to me at least, first have an sort of a revolution, an evolution of thinking. The history is, well, besides being just one darn thing after another, full of examples of efforts to improve, to change things that are quickly consumed by the old problems. As we get closer to crossing the point where the Earth can feed and sustain the number of humans on it, it seems to me we either have to get smarter in a real hurry about how we manage our resources and our energies, or there's going to be a lot less left to fight over.
Yeah, I think going back to the point that you made, a revolution or an evolution in thinking, I think what's required is a revolution in thinking. And at this point, it's going to have to come from outside of the educational system, because the educational system is geared somewhere else. Like I said, I wasn't familiar with Mr. Gatto and his writing, but I think his point in Designing Education for the Future, some of the points that he was making about preparing people for the place that society has for them, is exactly the role the education system plays, and there are even plans to further hone that, you know, for the actual future as it develops. And the charter school movement is an important part of that, because some of these successful charter schools are based upon cherry picking what's seen as the best of the students and preparing them for a certain kind of future, and then leaving the rest in a public school system that points them for even lower and lower roles in the society. And this question of sustainable approach to meeting society's needs is a key front in relation to this, because one very big thing looming for humanity is that on the current trajectory, the sustainable point is looming in front of us. And there is no serious attempt to stop racing toward the point of sustainability. And that comes down exactly to who controls and who runs society. Because it's actually, when you look at these international climate meetings, one of which is going on right now, what you have is you have the exploiters in the United States, the exploiters in Western Europe, the exploiters in, you know, ascending countries like China and Brazil, meeting each other and saying any changes done for the benefit of the environment are going to be at your expense, not mine. And that's actually been the terms of debate and struggle that have gone on since Kyoto and even before, and are going on right now. And how can China and Brazil have it that any steps to meet sustainability come at the expense of the United States and Europe, and the United States and Europe working for the reverse. And that's not going to do anything about the race to the point of sustainability and beyond it. And it's another reason why revolution is necessary. And it's also something that's addressed in the Constitution that we issued, because we tried to address all of the key questions that humanity faces. And this question of how do you educate a society, how do you change people's thinking, is a key part of it. And you do have to speak to some of the very real issues, including this one on the environment. Issue number 199, I believe, of Revolution Newspaper was a special issue that we put out on the crisis in the environment. And in it, we did things like putting forward principles of socialist sustainable development, because that was another arena within which the previous experience of communist revolution, it wasn't so good. You know, people did not grasp this looming environmental crisis and begin to take steps to deal with it. Well, but at this point, communist revolution has to grasp that and put forward a program to deal with it, and we're doing that through this constitution, which also talks about the educational system. And one of the points that it makes is that the role of the educational system in a socialist society would be to bring forward and educate and train people to understand reality as it actually is.
Seeing the real.
Yeah, you got to actually see what's real. You can't do anything about the real unless you see it. If you don't see it, it's going to hit you upside the head in one way or the other. So that would be the point of it. And then the other thing it says about education is that it would educate people to understand how the various oppressions that exist in society today, and that the socialist society would be trying to overcome it, would educate people to understand the historical development of those oppressions, the way in which men dominated and suppressed women, the way in which whole nations and peoples have been oppressed by more powerful nations and people through the colonialism of Europe and today's imperialism, principally on the part of the United States. So that would be the point of an educational system. And to get to the point where you could bring in a society that would have that kind of educational system, you've got to change the thinking of large numbers of people. And that does put you up against what this society is trying to do, because they are trying to educate people to accept this setup as necessarily permanent, that this is the way things are, and the best you can do is tinker with this around the margins, but don't even think that anything could be changed here. So that's a big challenge that the revolution faces, and there are a few different ways that we go at it. I spoke to some of them earlier in terms of trying to address the questions that are on people's minds, the things that people feel that they're up against, and then at the same time trying to build resistance, because one thing that we found, we go in some of, particularly some of the poorer neighborhoods, some of the housing projects in the ghettos and barrios across this country, and people don't respond to discussion of what the problems are. What brings them to respond is when they see you doing something about those problems.
Absolutely.
When they see that you're actually acting around the way the police treat them all the time, then they want to talk to you. When you come and talk to them about problems, even if it's a very real problem that they face, that's just talk to them. When they see you doing something about it, then they're like, oh, maybe you're real, maybe you're for real. So that's why we have that combination of approaches that I talked about earlier.
Well, that would be absolutely essential to bringing about change, is that people want to see an example. Okay, what's this future you speak of like? And I think one of the probably greatest opportunities, staying on the education topic here for just a couple moments longer, I don't remember which article it was. I think it was also by John Gatto, but he described the percentages of literacy among both white and African-American applicants to the Army before World War II and then after. And I believe it was some of the 84%, I believe, of the African-American population was literate when applying to the Army back in the World War II days. And it's down to like something like 26 now. For the whites, it was 99 and has now dropped to about 50. And this speaks to the larger problem of the success of the schooling effort has indeed made great compliant factory workers, but not people able to think. This seems to me to present a wide opportunity for a group such as yours, perhaps, to step in where the state is failing. The dropout rate among urban populations, regardless of race, it's the poverty that does it. There is nothing empowering for individuals living in poverty that are subjected to our schools. Whatever organization can come in to these areas and provide something of meaning, of substance, of social connection will have a leg up on the energies of this generation coming up now. Those of us who have gone for decades stewing in the media juices of conformity aren't as likely to take whole new cloth and try to build something from it. The young people coming up are the opportunity. Whether or not we have or there is sufficient time to educate a sufficient number of these people to be able to think independently and grasp the importance of new ideas before the currency collapses or the environment collapses is something that we will only find out in time.
Yeah, or before this fascist Tea Party movement is actually unleashed to the point of taking things drastically backward in this country. Because they actually are looking to do that. There are some interesting amendments that they want to get rid of to the Constitution, including some of the post-Civil War amendments. Some of them are aimed at the immigrant population, but they would play a very bad role overall. They want to get rid of the provision that anyone born in this country is a citizen, things like that. I guess what I wanted to go to in relation to that is, again, in relation to education, there's a way in which the education system is geared towards forcing out people who the system can't provide any meaningful position for. And in a certain sense, for many inner city youth, prison is actually their higher education. And it's kind of built in that way because you have large numbers of people who learn very early in school that they're not being prepared for one of those well-paying positions in society and see that their future is going to be one of getting some hustle together, legal or illegal, and then prison is there for them. And then on top of that, you have the very real discrimination in the criminal justice system, and I'll just cite one figure on that. That is that while the overwhelming majority of the people who use illegal drugs in this country, and a just society would have to change what's considered legal and illegal, because when you actually look at it, a drug like marijuana is much less a problem for society than alcohol, but alcohol is legal, marijuana isn't. Things like that would have to be changed, and not that we would want to make alcohol illegal, but we would stop arresting people for having some marijuana. But the overwhelming majority of the illegal drug users in this country are white. But if you trace that through the criminal justice system, the numbers of people who are arrested for illegal drug use, the numbers of people who are put on trial for illegal drug use, and the numbers of people who are put in jail for illegal drug possession, the numbers shift so that whites become the minority and blacks and Latinos become the overwhelming majority. So there's also discrimination there on top of the deprivation. There's discrimination that leads to large numbers of black and Latino youth ending up warehoused in prison.
Oh, it's
and one of the things,
it's hard to break in here, but it's absolutely in keeping with the intent when marijuana was illegalized. It was Richard Nixon's opening salvo into the drug war, and it was his way to get some leverage on the dirty effing hippies that were giving him so much grief. He had a staff member prepare a report, and the recommendation was, this is not dangerous, it's not harmful, it's not worth the resources. Nixon told him to change it or resign. He resigned. The next author put in all the paranoia required to scare people into the drug war, which we are still paying the consequences of.
Yeah, I mean, that's very real. And I guess the point I was going to make is how we're trying to address that. One way that we're trying to address it is we're trying to get the message of revolution into the prisons. And we support a program called the Prisoners Revolutionary Literature Fund, which provides subscriptions to Revolution newspaper and other revolutionary literature free to prisoners. And at this point, we have not only hundreds of prison subscribers, but hundreds more who are waiting for subscriptions. And we just need to come up with the funding to be able to meet that. And for each paper that goes into prison, we get reports back that, well, there are some people say, well, there's four other people who read this. One person wrote and says, I've got 30 people who are reading this. Can you send me another one? Because when it gets to the 30th person, it's usually falling apart. So it's having some impact there, an impact that we feel needs to grow, because we mainly are doing our work outside of prison, but we realize we got to reach into prison, because a lot of people there are people who need to hear this message, and there's some who want to hear it and want to spread it. And some of the experience coming back from these prisoners is very important, because it shows how if people can get a basic sense of why things are the way that they are, it can open up their thinking. Because we've gotten letters from prisoners who read about a book called The Science of Evolution, which we promoted in the pages of Revolution newspaper. We get a lot of letters from prisoners, can you send me that book? And these are people, many of them high school dropouts, who some of whom never really had a science class, but when they heard about this book, they wanted to get it, they wanted to read it, and then they wanted to try and turn others in the prison onto it. So this question of achieving revolution in people's thinking, there are examples that it can occur and move quickly. We just have to be able to get it going on a larger scale. And like I said, I think it has to come from outside the educational system at this point. There are people within the system, particularly teachers, who want to work with it, but the people who control the educational system, this is not what they have on their plans for the future. They actually want to take things more in the direction that they've already gone, and it's going to take a revolution in thinking to oppose that and to build up a movement for revolution that can change the whole society, which is what we are doing. We in the Revolutionary Communist Party are working on and doing.
Well, on that subject, let's take some of the remaining time we have left, and why don't you step us through this draft proposal for the Constitution for the new Socialist Republic in North America.
Okay. Well, let me start by speaking about its preamble, which basically lays out what this society is, how it came into being, and where it's trying to take things. And it says very clearly that unlike the previous society in this country and its founders, who talked about all men being created equal as they presided over a society that was based largely on enslaving people and was also based on even those who weren't enslaved, there was sharp differentiation of class. The founding documents of the society ignored that and tried to cover it over, creating the illusion that people were equal, when in fact there was no equality either intended or acting in reality. And in fact, there was a very sharp class distinction, and that class distinction was brought out when poor farmers in Massachusetts, I believe, I think it was Shea was the leader of this thing, took to heart the Declaration of Independence and tried to lead poor farmers in rebelling against the way that they were being deprived in the new American society. And those founding fathers who wrote the Declaration about the right that people have to rise up in resistance viciously crushed them. But this society will actually acknowledge, the Revolutionary Society will acknowledge that there remain differences among people, that some people in the old society were locked out of working with ideas, didn't get intellectual training, while others did get such training. And on the basis of that training, were compensated at much higher rates. But it says we're not going to knock everybody down to the same position all at once. We're going to make some big changes because private property in the natural resources, factories, large farms will no longer exist. That will become collective property. Private property in smaller holdings, like small farmers, things like that, would be allowed, but not to the point of exploiting the labor of others, and private property in terms of, you know, homes and goods and things like that that people are for their own use would, of course, be allowed. It lays all that out. And then it says we would work to transform from the differences among people that would be left over from the old society after that the capitalists and such have been expropriated of their capital. We would work to narrow out those differences. We would bring others into the intellectual arena, those who had been locked out. And like I said about the educational system, training and educating everybody in terms of understanding reality as deeply as possible in order to be able to transform it. It talks about the governing structure, and it speaks to how elections would be set up within 6 months after the revolution has been made for a national legislative body. There'd no longer be the Senate and House of Representatives thing, which actually made the Senate kind of a higher body within it. There'd just be one legislative body, and how the different sections of it would come together. There would be elections partly based on those people who had made the revolution, who would number in the millions and who would become part of the new provisional structure. There would be elections among them for a portion of the legislature. There would be society-wide elections for that. And then to replace the position of president, there would be an election once the legislator has been elected to elect an executive for the legislator and legislative body. And we think that it's important to lay that out, because in the past there was an identity, like in China, there was an identity, revolutionary China I'm talking about, there was an identity between the revolutionary party which led the revolution and the government. And while the revolutionary party would still be needed to play a leading role in society, this constitution lays out that that leading role would mainly come about through its political and ideological influence in society in terms of the way in which it was speaking to what the situation was and where things need to go, and convincing people throughout society of the correctness of those ideas, as opposed to stacking the government, so that there's no longer an identification between the Revolutionary Party and the government, but the government would have to be broad sections of people drawn from all walks of society, working on how the society needed to transform to continue to advance. And the reason that we felt that that was necessary to go in the Constitution is that the point of a socialist society, going back to Marx and Engels, is not just to collectivize the means of production and make a more just and fairer setup, but to actually go to the point of people consciously and voluntarily running society and transforming themselves. So they need to be involved in the process. And if there's just a few revolutionary leaders telling you what should be done and where things should go, and everybody else is trooping along behind them, it's not going to get you to where you need to go, because you want to get somewhere where you no longer need leaders to tell people what to do, because people themselves are conscious of what's going on and what needs to be done. And while you'll still need to discuss and debate out exactly what to do, because different people will have different ideas and nobody, the truth doesn't get discovered by everybody all at once, that won't be a process of, there's an institutionalized leadership that has to do that.
Yeah, we're going to have a great number.
Society.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it just occurs to me there's going to be a great number of years worth of disinformation hangover where people,
yeah,
meaning very well, we have ingrained in us from immersion in the environment for our whole lifetimes that certain things are what they are. And it keeps coming back to education and getting information out. But do go on.
Yeah. Actually, thanks for interrupting me, because I can you kind of let me go and I can keep going. It's good to break into it. And what I would add to that is, it's not just the disinformation hangover, but also just reality is complex and different people would have different angles to that reality. And you never can tell whose angle is going to lead to something correct. That's even part of why you need to hear from people who think you're doing the wrong thing, because somebody who thinks you're doing the wrong thing might, through the course of their argumentation, bring forward something that's correct. And if you block them out because you don't agree with them, you're also blocking out something that might be true that you need to know in order to keep going in the right direction. So that's an important principle of it. And then the Constitution also goes into how the economy would be organized. It goes into how the educational system would be run. It goes into how the media would work. And I just want to touch on that in a little bit of detail.
Please.
Because when you look at today, the media is dominated by corporate media, media that frankly serves the interests of the handful of people who own and control the wealth and power in this society. Well, that media would no longer be there. What you would have is, you would have media run by the government. Part of the point to it, and it puts this forward in the Constitution, is this media should put forward a diversity of ideas, including having space for those who want to argue against the government, either in particular or in general, that has to be a part of the government media. And then on top of that, there are provisions for independent media that, as opposed to today where independent media has to scrap and scrape in order to be able to survive, the government would put out a level of funding for that independent media. And again, that independent media could not be based upon support for the government, that it has to include people who want to argue against the government. So if there are people in there, and I'm thinking, like in India, Arundhati Roy is actually a very important figure. And she said at one point that on a lot of things she thought the communists were right, and she supported them on a lot of things, but she thought that she would be one of the first people that they would want to eliminate when they got to power, because she would be a critic of them as well as a critic of the current Indian government. And in response to that, we said, in fact, Bob Avakian said, the Revolutionary Society would need people like Arundhati Roy, and it would be exactly the wrong thing to try to silence her, because it would need critics who were willing to go before all of society and say, this government is wrong, either in part, and in particular she was talking about an irrigation project being done by the current Indian government, which is going to dispossess a lot of Indian farmers, but also referring to the fact that even under socialism, the Chinese government put forward irrigation projects, which also dispossessed a lot of farmers, and she said she would criticize them both. Well, a socialist society would need critics who said, this project that you're doing is wrong for this reason, whether that's because it despoils the environment or it wrongly dispossesses people who should not be dispossessed, so that those questions could be debated before society and a correct course emerge out of that debate, not out of the government having the power to push its position through. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to mention there that having defined structure in place to provide for that will be essential, because individuals in positions of authority are, just by virtue of us all being human, are going to want to protect that authority, are going to resist being told that the plans they spent 5 years formulating are wrong and should be junked. It's going to take a lot of discipline to maintain that sort of openness.
Yeah, it is. And part of the point to putting out a document that says the society we're aiming to bring into being has to include this kind of openness is so that people who come to see that we're taking the right step and doing things that are important and should be supported also know what our aims are, what our goals are, and what methods we've laid out for getting there, so that if the Revolutionary Party or if the new revolutionary government begins to go in ways that are against that, people can say, wait a minute, it says right here. And then that can become a big part of discussion in society. We want to actually train people today in taking that kind of approach. We think that that's the kind of approach that can lead us in developing the best possible course for building a movement for revolution and getting to the point where a revolution could be made in a country like this, but also in terms of directing the new revolutionary authority. We want this understanding and these principles to be part of the collective property of society, so that if people in authority succumb to the pull of, hey, we're in charge now, we can do this thing our way, and violate some of these principles, there are people who will see that, understand that, and then call the question on that and open up the society to debate and discuss it and keep people from doing that. That's kind of the check that exists on that. The one other thing I wanted to bring into the media discussion is there's also a provision for self-generated media. If there are people who do not want to do their independent media on the basis of government support, people could generate media, including media that exists to criticize the government, either on particular things or that it's generally going the wrong way. So what we're trying to lay the basis and open things up for is a very lively media situation where there are opposing viewpoints coming out in the media, including in the government media, with people being trained to go for what's true. And one thing that'll get us beyond, you know, because you can look at Fox News and you get a lot, in a certain sense you can say it's lively and combative, it's not very connected into the truth.
Yes.
Then you could look at, you know, maybe an MSNBC thing, and there was a point where if Obama and them were doing it, it was good. That point is actually being transcended by some of his compromises, so MSNBC is beginning to criticize him. But you don't want a setup where people feel that they have interests that they are trying to protect and defend in the media, and doing that requires, you know, going away from what's true and what's real. That's what you want. You want a reality-based, lively, combative media scene.
Well, and that's having the entertainment arm of the networks take over the news branch helped lead us to the depths we now suffer. We've just got a few minutes left, so I'm wondering if you could speak briefly towards the economic system, not only the challenges exist in our present one, but what would the new structure, a fairer, more equitable structure, look like, both national and international?
All right, let me say a couple things. One is, as I said before, private ownership of the natural resources, factories, lines, all of that, would no longer exist in the new revolutionary society. And wherever there were U.S. corporations that claimed such ownership around the world, to the degree possible, the revolutionary society would end that as well. I mean, the world would not be under its control, so some of that might continue on, or maybe other imperialists would try to take it. But this new society would renounce such ownership, and related to that, it would also renounce military bases around the world that the U.S. today uses to dominate such things. Private ownership would be allowed to exist. It would be incorporated into the overall economic plan for society, because we think a planned economy based on broad involvement throughout the society is the way to develop an economy that can eliminate the exploitation, eliminate the division between those who work with their minds and those who have to work with their backs, the locking out of people from intellectual endeavor, that would be the approach to take, and that would mean that you would have to have local, regional, and national planning bodies that coordinated their activity. And the basic principle for the new society would be meeting the needs of the people, not how do you produce profit. We would include within that, just in the international arena, assisting people in other parts of the world who were struggling to make revolution, as well as looking at where the U.S. society dispossessed people in other parts of the world and working on that too, because it would no longer be a thing. Today, U.S. society exists on the backs of countless, well, actually billions of people now around the world. That would no longer be the case. And we would also be looking at how do we reverse some of that and make some of that good. Let me also tell people how they can get the Constitution, because I don't want to miss that. I sometimes forget that. You can go online to the website www.revcom.us. That's revcom.us. It is posted there. In Boston, you could also go to Revolution Books if you're old school and want it in hard copy. And the phone number there is area code 617-492-5443. That's 617-492-5443.
Well, Carl, this hour has gone by incredibly quickly, and I'm afraid to say that it is just about up. I thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning and expand our awareness on the new draft proposal for your Constitution, and we hope to have you back. Maybe after the summer and some more events transpire, we'll have another chat. Carl Dix does join us for you in New York?
I'm in New York right now.
Okay, and he's a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party of USA, and we thank him for joining us. And that's all the time that we have for today. You've been listening to Truth and Justice Radio here on WZBC Newton, where every Sunday from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. we bring you, or do the best we can to bring you, 4 hours of spirited examination of war, empire, corrupted justice, engineered poverty and schooled ignorance, corporate criminality, and crooked politicians, all in our sights.